Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing in life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, please head right on over to pnwa.org. Speaking of the PNWA, this Saturday, February, I don't know what, first I guess it is, I will be teaching part two of my three-part memoir class. It's filling up pretty quick. It might be full. But if you're a member of the PNWA, you can sign up for that at pnwa.org. And tonight, this is Tuesday, January 28th, tonight I will be at the University Bookstore in Seattle, Washington, having a live conversation with the wonderful Ruth Ozeki about her book, A Tale for the Time Being. If you want to stop by the University Bookstore right there in the heart of the University District, go right ahead. I'll be there. So, I've been doing a lot of memoirs, talking to a lot of memoirists recently, and I love talking about memoir. I love teaching it because when you deal with memoir, you get to ask two of my favorite questions, which are, what makes a good story and what is life? What is life? Because when we write the memoir, we often kind of look back at our lives and say, what just happened? I know something happened. I know it was meaningful, but I need to write this book to find out. And that's kind of what happened to my guest today, Claire Dieterer, who is a writer, but 10 years ago, her back went out, and so she started doing yoga at suggestion of a great many people. And of course, as often happens, these things change our lives, but it changed for her in unexpected ways, including doing the yoga, getting her to reevaluate what a good person really was. Who would have thought that doing yoga would have brought about such a shift in perception? But it did for her, and that's why we write the book, and that's why I have her on the show today. Claire, welcome to Author.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. Change in our life, Claire, I was thinking about this as I was thinking about your book, so often begins, unfortunately, the big changes with pain, some kind of pain. And that fit literally began, was the case for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, the practical reason I started doing yoga was I was sort of hefting my enormous baby daughter out of her car seat. And you have to, anybody who's ever had a baby or been around a baby knows that there's a very particularly tortuous sort of turn and twist to get a baby out of a backseat car seat. And I had a really large baby, and deliciously large. And I lifted her, and the back went out, and I lived at the time it was 1999, and I lived on Finney Ridge in Seattle, which is one of the just sort of classic liberal bubble communities of the Northwest.
You know,
it's
well.
Finney Ridge, Berkeley, Park Slope, all of these places sort of have a certain ethos that is shared. And of course, because I lived on Finney Ridge, you know, nobody said take a muscle relaxant or, you know, lie down for 5 days. They all said do yoga. So that's how I started doing yoga. It was a physical pain.
It starts with the physical pain, but what was interesting, now you had been writing, I mean, you were a writer at this point. It wasn't that you were just kind of tootling along and back went out and yoga. You were, that was your career, that was your life, a nonfiction writer. But you had never written a full memoir before this, had you?
No, I had not. I started as the film critic at Seattle Weekly. Yeah. And then I went on from there to become a book critic and do a lot of kind of national freelancing, doing book criticism and arts writing. And I started becoming more and more interested because I was coming from a critical background. After a while, that gets old, criticizing other people's work.
Yes,
and I started
I would
to get
think
interested.
So.
Yeah, it's, I mean, in a way, it's a huge, it can be a really positive thing because you're bringing someone's work to light and you're engaging it in other people's writing in a really deep way. So it's not entirely a negative thing. But I started to become interested in telling my own story and, yeah. You know, or telling any kind of story that would then in turn be open to other criticism. Or in other words, just to make something, right?
Yeah.
Make something
yeah.
of my own. And so I started writing long-form personal essays. And then I was writing a lot on, I was writing on yoga, but I was also writing on feminism and the 1970s, and I was writing on motherhood. And so when I went to write Poser, which was maybe 10 years after the event you describe,
yeah.
when I went to write the book, those three threads came together that I'd already been writing on.
Right. And this is the way our imagination works, I think. And I say our imagination, even though you're writing about things that were real and a part of your life, the things that are compelling to us float forward, I think, often without us understanding why they've floated forward. And the wise writer just follows their nose, you know, and sees that something's lighting up. It sounds like that was what was happening with you even before you started writing Poser.
I think that that's so. I think that when I was working on that writing, I think it was very much in separate columns, kind of the motherhood,
mm-hmm.
the
yeah.
History of feminism, and the yoga. And what happened was I started to think about writing a book about yoga, and I became kind of captivated by what I found to be a comical idea of writing a book which would have each chapter organized around a yoga pose.
Uh-huh.
And I had an agent, and she said, well, you should try to write a memoir about that. And I was like, well, that is a great idea, except for nothing has ever happened to me. So how will I write a memoir? I'm very ordinary. And then my husband, who's also a writer, and I started talking about using the poses as a vessel to talk about feminism and motherhood. And I went away, and I think this is really important, especially for parents. I went away and started, you know, had like 3 days to myself to focus and really started putting those ideas next to each other. And they just, you know, those themes of virtue and goodness and how we're supposed to be and how we really are, they emerged really quickly. And what I think about a lot, I liked what you said about kind of following our interest and so forth. And Twyla Tharp has a great quote where she says, you don't have an idea until you have two ideas. And I think about that a lot. You can't sort of do something with one idea. It needs something to bump up against, which is certainly the case for me. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and I love that the book looked into a deeper understanding of goodness, because I feel that as a writer, you know, if you're progressive politically, which I know, surprise, surprise, I am also, but if that's where you're inclined, there is this thing about not offending people, you know, not to hurt people's feelings. And the truth is, there is nothing I can write that there won't be some person somewhere on planet Earth who will, for some reason, take offense to it. I could write about bunnies and someone will take offense to it. And I do think that as a writer, you have to begin to get a deeper understanding of what it is to be good, and especially as it relates to other people. Does that make sense in terms of
yeah,
the way people see you as good, or what real goodness is?
I'd never really connected that to the writing of Poser. I've thought about it thematically a lot in terms of what I wrote about in Poser. I think, you know, first of all, there's like a, I don't know if you agree with this, but there's, to my mind, a solid, rock-solid law to writing memoir, which is you always have to mock, eviscerate, you know, destroy, make fun of yourself
yes.
more than anyone else. And if you do that with vigor and with, you know, humor and intelligence, and just you're a little bit savage toward yourself, it's amazing what you can get away with toward other people.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're always the first on the chopping block. And so I think that's, you know, and I never, the other thing is I do think you should be very honest in what you write about, whether it's bunnies or yoga or progressive politics or the idea of virtue. But, you know, never, as long as you're never writing with a vendetta or to make someone else
yeah.
look bad, when that sour taste is there, the reader knows, and they know that they're reading a work of bad faith. So don't do it,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, that's just what – so when Andre Debuse wrote Townie, which was his memoir, which was the mm-hmm. book he wrote for his most recent one, it's a really good memoir, but he was you know, he was a fiction writer. He's like, I don't write memoir. I don't want to do this. And he was talking to Richard Russo, the novelist, and, mm-hmm. and Russo said to him, "Are you settling a score? And if you're settling a score, don't do it."
Exactly.
And he said, no. But you know, I will tell you, the memoir I wrote, there was some score settling at first and all. I did that, and then I took it out, and then I went back to myself. But
right,
I started a little bit with other people.
Well, that's the glory of writing. Of course you can write it. You know, that's the great thing is you can write it. And then you can, you know, what we want to do is we want to recognize, and that's one of the things where writing is very similar to life in that, you know, it goes best when we're able to be self-reflexive and really assess what we're doing. And so, you know, if we can be our own best reader and see like, oh, I really am settling a score there. And I had certain, you know, I was writing about my parents, so that's always a dangerous territory in terms of I want to say what I didn't think went exactly right in my childhood, but I don't want to point a finger. And so I had very specific narrative strategies that I used that made it so I could do that.
And did you have to find those? I mean, did you start saying, I want to write about this time my mom, and like, that didn't work. How am I going to do it? And did you have to really discover them?
Yeah, I really suffered through that. When I was first writing the book, and I had to write the book, I sold it before I wrote it. I was on contract.
So I was a little
bit wigged out. It was due. And I was writing it, and I was trying to sort of describe certain elements of my childhood without, you know, pointing my knobby finger at my parents. And my husband said the funniest thing. He said, you know, if you only write nice things about nice people, you won't have a memoir, you'll have a newsletter. And so I started to write, first of all, based on exactly what you said, that feeling that I can back off later, I can edit later, but right now I need to write the truth of what will happen. And for me, I quickly found that what I needed was a moral parameter that I was having. And there's all kinds of moral issues that come up in writing memoir and are really interesting. My moral issue was, how much can I reveal about my parents or anyone else I write about without feeling like I'm doing them harm? And what I came away with as my strategy, which was very much a utilitarian strategy and, you know, developed in the middle of the writing, it was that I would only describe things that happened. So I never psychologically analyze my parents. I never, you know, sort of have some explanation for why they did what they did. I never tried to indict them. I just said what happened. And for me, that felt really, it also kind of went with the theme of Poser, which is trying to live in reality rather than an ideal. You know, so the method sort of served the theme of the book. But for me, that was a really supple and useful way to approach writing about other characters. And I teach this with students, and people tend to find that it's quite a sturdy way to approach, you know, real-life humans that can be affected by, it will be affected by these things. That's the thing. People are going to be affected by your memoir.
Yeah, they are. But I do think that you took the right idea, and that's kind of been the approach I've taken, which is I can analyze I will go into my own thinking considerably, because I think that's often an important, for me at least, to understand my motivation, I have to at least reveal the way in which I was seeing the world at that time, which is always why I do what I do. But it's true, I've also found that when dealing with other people, it's best just to let their actions speak for whatever their motivations may or may not have been. It's the fairest way, for sure. Because you don't actually know. You don't know what anyone, I think I know what even my wife is thinking, but I'm often wrong. And I know she's wrong about me.
We barely know what happened, let alone what other people are. You can barely remember what actually happened, right?
I know. That's the other thing you've got to deal with, isn't it? Like, you know, you're not inventing. It's not a million, 10,000, million little pieces or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that is what it was. But the fact is, you've got to deal with this immediately, that you don't really know what happened. You don't really know what was said. You're dealing with what it felt like, pretty much. And then some sense of, I'm pretty sure that on that day, he hit me or I lost that, you know. But you don't really, really, really know. I don't anyway.
No, there's no way. It's all built on shifting sand. And I think a student actually just said to me this morning, she was quoting from Lydia Yuknovich, if you know her work.
Yeah.
She wrote this
I know Lydia.
Oh, you do?
Did a great interview with her.
Give her my regards. I'm a huge booster of her work. And there's a quote from Chronology of Water where she says, the only real memories are the ones you don't know you have or that you haven't had. So
that's
whenever
good.
You tell yourself a memory, you kill it, right?
Yeah.
And it's very hard to know exactly what happened. And that's why we're so lucky to have writers like Tobias Wolff and Jeffrey Wolff, who are siblings who've both written great works of literature about their childhood, right?
Yeah.
Totally different works of literature.
And that would be the case, I'm sure, if my brother and sister were to write books about our childhood. And in fact, my brother does these little bits every once in a while. He's a funny guy, does these videos, and he'll talk about our childhood, and I'll have forgotten completely about these things that were so significant that were around shared experiences. We both had the same cat for the same pet. You know, it's funny. You said something interesting earlier, and this is something that I teach memoir to, and so I get these similar kind of questions to what you said, which is I can't write a memoir because nothing happened to me. You know, that my life, I haven't been shipwrecked on an island, I didn't climb a mountain, I didn't go to, but isn't the, and I think sometimes the great threat for the one who wants to write the memoir is to have had something amazing happen to them, and that they rely on the events instead of the real story, which is always far below the events, right? What did it feel like? What was the reality of those? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I've actually never thought that before. That's really interesting how having a crucial event could be a detriment to writing well or could hang you up. That's really interesting.
I'll
buy it because I know that when I write what is very difficult, the scenes that are very difficult for me to write are the set pieces of important events. And I notice I procrastinate on those, and they're hard to kind of get to. So that's very interesting. And the fact is that I love memoirs of ordinary life. I read cookbooks for fun, so obviously I'm interested in how people live. Or I think a lot about Little House on the Prairie are the books I think about a lot. Because they're not memoirs, they're fiction, but she spends a chapter on Laura and Pa building a fish trap, and I'm like turning the pages to see what happens next. We can go, we're fascinated by how people live, and it's because it's cozy and intimate, but it's also voyeuristic and kind of thrilling.
Now, a mutual friend of ours, Theo Pauline Nestor, there's an interview with her right now on Author. It's great. I got to meet her for the first time. I loved her. She was great. And she said something that I really think is true, which is that, you know, I've read a couple memoirs like Andre Debuse's and like Ingrid Rick's book, Hippie Boy, which I just read recently. Those are really
I heard that was great.
It's really good. It's really – but that – see, now – Hippie Boy reads like a first-person novel. And if you told me it was a first-person novel, I'd believe you. It's just pure showing, no telling. And it reads, and it's very compelling story to see. But this is what Theo talks about. And I think she's absolutely right, that with memoir, you have the option of showing and telling, of saying what I call it the soliloquy, just like in Shakespeare when he says, okay, Hamlet's now going to step forward and say, let me talk about life and death. That you can do that in memoir if you want. I mean, you can do anything you want, but it works in memoir better than it would work in fiction. Do you buy
that? The new book, it's very much the way I write. And it's funny you should bring up Theo, and I'll circle around to that in a second. But first I want to say that Philip Lopate, the great essayist, has a new book out called To Show and to Tell. And in that book, he laments the way that memoir has come to be taught too much like fiction and had an emphasis on exactly what you described, that novelistic scene writing, first person, very tight, and that he thinks that memoir and nonfiction writing can and ought to draw back and make broad statements.
Yes.
And it's very brilliant how he writes. What's that?
I said amen. And in fact, you know what's interesting? I hadn't thought of this till very recently. And so I'm going to here's my theory, my grand theory, and you can tell me what you think of. But my first introduction to writing was reading novels when I was a boy, reading Lord of the Rings and all these novels I loved. But very soon after that, I discovered poetry. And I really loved poetry. And I didn't realize until recently, because I write a daily column essay for the magazine, which is about my life and writing and life and blah, blah, blah. And I realized that poetry is almost like a link to memoir in that it is a form of creative nonfiction that says, look at life. And sometimes what I'm doing in memoir is similar to what the poet does by saying, there's no story here, there's no characters here, but I want to offer this perception using language artistically to offer this window into what life and the soul and love is. Does that resonate with you, that poetry almost is a kind of memoir in a way?
I love that idea because it takes you away from, you know, the more traditional idea of what story is and what event
yes.
is. And it acknowledges yeah. that there's a lot, you know, my whole thing is that the only story in memoir, the essential story of memoir, is the transformation of the narrator.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And that can be anything. You know, that can
absolutely.
Be... That can be Jeff Dyer in Out of Sheer Rage acknowledging that he's never going to write his important D.H. Lawrence book. That's the whole transformation of the narrator, and I'm, you know, gripped from beginning to end. Or it can be
yeah.
an actual event occurring to people. So, yeah, I think that's a really nice observation. And it's funny you should bring up Theo in terms of showing on Not Telling, because last year, I'm a very telly writer, and I think it's because I come from a critical background.
Yeah,
I love to tell. My book has a lot of broad, you know, social context, statements
right.
about historical moment, and philosophical ideas. I love all that stuff. And I went
right.
through a phase last year where I decided that was garbage, and I was only going to write in scene. Only in scene.
Right.
So during this period where I, like, had a mania about this, because I was working on my second book, and I was writing it all in scene, I went to speak at Theo's class. And I sat down with her students, and I said, you should only be writing in scene. You should have no historical context, no jokes, no this, no that. And Theo just looked at me and she said, are you crazy? And she pulled out a copy of my book and she started reading passages from it. And she said, you know, she said, look, you do historical context here, you do social commentary here, you do humor here. And, you know, this is what you're doing. And it broadens the scene writing. And then she just looked at me and she said, do you hate yourself? Because it's what you do. And I had to go home and think about it. Was I hating the voice I had developed in Poser, and was I swinging in a, you know, too far, like a pendulum in the opposite direction? Because you do that with work, you know? You sort of, oh, I'm tired of that
absolutely.
Voice. I want to try something different.
And in fact, I tried the memoir I'm just finishing now, or I've just finished now. I tried to really make it story, 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 and it wanted some of that telling, but I found that, and then I tried doing just telling, like almost like a straight sort of long essay, and that didn't work either. But when I took those things and put them in context with the story, then it made sense. But what I was going to say, and I, by the way, I have a caller who has a question, but I may not get to you, just so you know, caller. So I'm sorry about that. But I wanted to make this point. You were saying, I love that stuff. I love the historical context. I love the telly's things. And the beauty of when you love something, this is my opinion on this, when you love something, you understand in a unique way why it's valuable. The people who love romance novels know why romance novels should be read and written in a way I don't, because I don't love them. But because you love that kind of writing, you know why it should be on the page and what is cool about it in a way someone who only wants to see thinks they only want to see story. Does that make sense? That your
yeah,
love
that's
of it
really
is
interesting.
Something about value, and that's your guide.
And you need to, I mean, it's an interesting problem because you, it's very good for us to read outside what we love
uh-huh.
and to
oh,
think
yeah.
about, you know, from a critical perspective, just as growing as a reader and a writer, it's really great to think, I don't love this genre, but if I did, would this be a good book in that genre? I think that's a really useful way to look at writing, as you know, and take apart what's good about it. Like, because you can look at romance novels, for instance, and get a lot of information about how to plot.
Yes.
So you could use it in that way. But in terms of writing a creative piece of work, you can only write about something that's deeply interesting and lovable to you. Because you're going to
yes.
get so freaking bored of this piece of writing. So you better love it to start with.
It's like a marriage. You better love the person you're with. I was writing about this the other day on my column. But you better love the person you're with, because you will reach a moment when the marriage is, or the relationship is, going through that valley, just like the middle of a book. And if you don't love that person, it's not worth it. You split it. Like, well, why do I go through this? But if you love the person, you understand that on the other end of it, there's something. And I feel it the same way with a book. You always reach a point where it's like, I don't have a clue, and I think I hate this thing, but I can't
yeah.
put it down, because I ultimately I know I love it.
But then it's to take the metaphor a little further, if it's a subject matter and you write extensively about it, not only it's like getting married to someone and then killing them. Because with subject matter, as opposed to your relationship to the book itself, so take yoga as my subject matter. Right. I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, and I can never write another yoga. I can barely speak the word yoga out loud. It is dead to me. I killed that thing. And this is a nonfiction writer thing. You just wear out topics when you explore them deeply. And it's not a very popular thing to say, but it's something that's, you know, whispered by nonfiction writers.
But does that lead you someplace else? Because you still, I mean, yoga was a beginning, but now your interest has got to have shifted to someplace else, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. It's very true. So, you know. And I, you know, and it goes to the other thing, which is you write the book you want to read. I, at the time that I first had the idea for that book, there were no funny, complicated, plotted, sort of complex memoirs about yoga, and yet I was having this crazily emotional relationship with it. And so I wanted to read that book.
Yes.
Like, I wanted to read it bad.
I'm
and
so
that's
glad
why
you
I wrote it.
Said that. Best way to write a book. That is the best way to write a book. You can't find a because you want to see it on the bookshelf. That's why I tell my students, write the book you wish existed that doesn't.
That's what Seymour Glass said to Zoe in Franny and Zoe. He says flat out explicitly, write the book you want to read.
Yeah.
You know, and you can cling to that. That is something to hang on to in a dark moment to me. It has been my whole life.
That's what David Bowie said. I saw an interview with him. He said, well, I figured I made music, and I knew I liked it, so that's one. And then I just had to hope there were other people out there who liked it, too. Because I didn't know, but I did know that I liked it. So there, you're in good company with David Bowie.
Yeah, the best company. That's great. I love that. Because that's all you can really go by.
What? Because you don't know. I was just thinking about this morning. You know, I'm finishing this book, and I sent it out there, and I'm like, look, Bill, there's going to be the people who like it, and there's going to be the people who don't. And you love it, and you have no idea who else is going to like it, but you do know that you like it. And just let that be enough, will you? I forget all the time. The ego can't stand it, Claire. The ego wants everybody to love it or everybody to hate it. This in-between thing just drives the ego nuts. That's the truth.
Right. There's no such thing as a mid-list ego, right?
No. Oh, no. My God. No, you're a failure at the top of the world. Okay, we got about 2 minutes left. I want you to answer one more question. Jeff, I'm sorry I didn't get to your question, but all right. Here we go. Ready? The one last question. I want you to finish a sentence for me.
Okay.
If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
Oh. Okay. This is what came to my mind, so I'm just going to tell you.
Go with it.
It's taught me to suffer.
Taught you to suffer.
It's taught me the value of suffering through something. That nothing good comes without suffering. Nothing real can be made without really suffering over it. And that doesn't mean it has to be reflected in the work. You know, I like to think I'm a pretty funny writer, but to have not only, you know, that it makes the work better, but to sort of like everybody suffers. And if you're making something, at least you have somewhere to put it, right? It's within the kind of rubric of this thing you're making. So that's my answer.
That is excellent. Claire, listen, so it's Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. I'm hoping there will be another book. Do you think one might be coming?
I think one might come. I'll let you know.
Okay. In the meantime, good luck. I enjoy your essays and your stories and your teaching, and I hope we get to have you on the show again.
I'd love to. Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Claire. All right. Suffer. Yes, you do. If you're going to change, you got to suffer. Do you know the Greek word for suffering is to move through? To move through. And she's right. To finish, do something of value, you got to move through and become something new. And that's what writing's all about. It's what it's all about. So, let's see. Next week, Susan Rich, the poet Susan Rich, will be on talking about poetry, I guess, and life, and who knows what else. Again, tonight, I'll be at the University Bookstore. That's January 28th in Seattle, Washington, talking to Ruth Ozeki. Until then, well, you know what you got to do. I want all of you to sit down tomorrow and write the book you want to write. Write the book you want to read, even better. Write the book you want to read. Write the book that you would love to read. And if you do that, you really can't go wrong. Do what you love.
love who you love. You'll be all right.